This is Storycatcher with Patricia Glynn. Welcome to Inspirations, stories that go deeper with people who go further. We're stepping into the world of Southern Africans who are truly exceptional. And because they're living big and asking the big questions, our conversations here are longer than those on Potpourri. I was in Hoedspruit last month, as you might know. It's called South Africa's Safari Capital because it borders several of our game parks. And I had the most interesting day in the Klisiri Game Reserve with Dr. Kyle Mark Middleton and his wife, soon-to-be doctor, Kerry Hickman. They're biologists studying a very little studied bird, the southern ground hornbill. You know, those big black birds with the bright red necks and impossibly long eyelashes. I've always found them a bit creepy, I have to confess. The way they stalk the land in their black coats with stiff legs and booming tuba voices. They look like mafia assassins, and they behave like them too, as it turns out. My morning with Kyle Mark and Carrie confirmed that, but by the end of it, spoiler alert, I had completely changed my mind about them. And that's because the couple are discovering some truly astonishing things about what some refer to as thunderbirds.
When we're approaching the nest, you can talk. Obviously not screaming, and we're not going to be screaming. Just talk. So if she is in there, she's going to be aware. It's just kind of letting her know we are there. We generally try and stay as calm as possible, just in case that she, you know, we don't want to make her nervous. We are disturbing her if she is in the nest, but it's very much about minimizing that disturbance.
Kyle, Mark and Carrie are going to check one of the artificial nests they've put up for the birds in various places in the Greater Kruger National Park. Kyle Mark takes a ladder from the roof of the car and we walk about 300 meters into the hot and baked Mopani veld to a grove of high trees. Kyle Mark extends the ladder and climbs up about 5 meters to something like a small dog kennel that's wedged between some thick branches. How ironic that something called the ground hornbill nests so high. He peeps into the nest. It's empty. Again. Possibly because of the late rains. Possibly because of, well, multiple reasons that the biologists are trying to identify. What are the nests made of?
We've got a few different designs. This one is made of M1 composite. It's almost like a kind of concrete. But then we've got other ones, which we'll see next. It's a wooden nest with special designs. They all got different purposes. This one's built for strength. The other one's built more for research purposes. So there's like hidden compartments and double layered so that it buffers temperatures a little bit more and stuff like that. So, I mean, the nest designs are constant upgrade. Unfortunately, the birds are really destructive, so they peck the nests to death. I mean, they peck holes straight through walls. Even these concrete ones have gone straight through. So we need to design something that's really sturdy, that's going to last a long time, but also that's not going to be a hot box inside and constant development.
So they keep the same nests and just do a little bit of renovations every year.
I wouldn't call it renovation, I'd call it destruction.
They destroy and then do the hubbies have to come and renovate? What's the system?
Yeah, so the female alone incubates, and then the males and the rest of the group will actually bring food and actually bring some leaf lining. Every time they come to the nest, they generally bring leaves and things like that, and it just creates a nice layer that the birds can actually sit on. It's a bed, pretty much, nice and soft.
Normally the hornbills nest in natural cavities in very large trees, like this one, but they're seldom water, heat and predator proof. Perhaps you picked up that the alpha pair does all the breeding and is supported by a group of exclusively male consorts. See, mafiosi. Seriously though, this social structure is highly unusual. There's lots about this bird we don't know. When dominant pairs in wild creatures monopolize breeding, it's known as a cooperative breeding strategy, a social system in which offspring receive care not only from their parents, but also from additional group members, often called helpers. But why male helpers? The detailed research that Kyle, Mark and Carrie have done over 5 years shows that males bring more and bigger food to the nest, ensuring good, steady nutrition for the nestlings.
Mm-hmm. I spent time painting this nest to make it camouflage, so much so that I drove past it the last time.
The nest has been up for about 4 years or more now, waiting for the birds to take occupation, making the Middletons very patient people. They have to be. They're studying a bird that lives for 50 or 60 years. A lifespan of that length puts the ground hornbills among the longest-lived birds in the world. As a comparison, the albatross and the African grey parrot both have lifespans of about 60 years. So because the ground hornbills live so long, they can therefore afford to breed only when conditions are optimal.
We have a lot of conflicts between groups, and we've seen females come in and oust another female and kind of take over the group. And so there's a lot more chopping and changing than originally thought. But it is generally like we have some females that have bred for 20 years in a row, and others that just breed once and then don't breed again for 10, 15 years. So
yeah,
it's very much dependent probably on the area that they live in, like the kind of habitat, and on the individual.
That is just incredible to my mind. How many species do you know that produce offspring a decade or more apart? With that slow rate of reproduction, frankly, I'm surprised these birds haven't gone the way of the dodo.
Here's the question that gets scientists so annoyed. I mean, do they have different characters or personalities, these birds?
Yeah, definitely. We install camera traps at the nests.
Yes, I saw that.
Check now. From those camera traps, we can see their different behaviours. We see their different vocalizations. We see how they interact with each other. And 100% they have their own personalities. We actually watched some footage the other day, and I instantly could tell that there was something wrong. The group seemed very agitated. Mm. And that's from me looking at these camera traps for 6-7 years of knowing the groups and knowing their unusual behaviour, and then knowing when something's strange and different. Some are very bold and aggressive, some are shy.
Some have particular habits, the way that they approach the nest. They usually like follow the same route to get to the nest, and some just jump straight in.
Yeah, and how they treat each other as well. Some females can be very dominant and quite aggressive, especially the youngsters. And other females are very tolerant of the youngsters, even coming inside the nest with her.
We've even got one particular bird that hates our camera trap.
Yeah.
No matter where we try and hide them or disguise them, the bird just finds them and destroys
them.
Now that you've got to see. Kyle, Mark and Carrie have provided us with several of the videos from their camera traps, and you'll find them in our photo deck attached to this podcast. Have a look when you're done. I mean, it's a great recommendation for the camera that it survives the attack. The bird's fury is terrifying, and the strength of that hammering bill. The cameras have been game changers in the Middletons' research. They're small, the footage and the audio is really clear, and it can be collected, taken home, and studied at leisure. By this means, Kyle Mark has made some mind-blowing discoveries, and they've been embargoed until very, very recently.
Very, very new research. So because of these camera traps that we use, we've been able to get really nice vocalizations of them coming to the nest with food. And it's been very recently found that it seems that they're almost advertising what food they're bringing to the chick or the female inside the nest. It kind of displays a certain level of intelligence in the species that probably was not thought of previously. It's a behavior that's only really been shown or found so far, I'm going to say so far, because I'm sure there's other species, but it's mainly in primates, dolphins, and ravens. You know, species that are in those three groups are generally considered as highly, highly intelligent species. So
It's really, really, really interesting stuff.
That surely is. Bottlenose dolphins, which Kyle Mark mentioned, whistle while foraging or finding prey. Scientists believe that if a group of dolphins finds a school of potential prey, they will vocalize more frequently to alert the pod. How precise that notification is, well, that's the whole point. And in the ground hornbills, Kyle Mark has uncovered some pretty amazing behavior.
And how detailed is their differentiation between the foods?
So at the moment, it's just been separated into vertebrates and invertebrates. So pretty much your bigger prey items like scrub hares and snakes and things like that compared to insects. And that's the distinguishing characteristic mm-hmm. between the two so far.
Mm-hmm. And it could be because they're cooperative breeders. It's a very fine line. They have to almost kind of contribute in order to be remain within the group. So it's that pay to stay. The non-breeders, they have to show that they're contributing to the group. So my theory is that they're giving this information about prey items as if to kind of boast about what they've brought. But I mean, that we don't know.
I mean, it's definitely in the cooperative breeding, it's definitely been shown that, you know, certain species will not just bring food for the sake of bringing food. It's, they bring it, but then they'll wait for some other individual to be there so that they can actually show.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's okay. You know, then they get benefit from that. It's the whole mm-hmm. question of there, is there true altruism in nature?
Yeah. You know,
because if it was, then they would just bring it and leave it.
And leave it.
But if they're waiting for someone to see them, then there's some kind of benefit involved with that, that they're trying to get out of that.
Yeah, fascinating.
Mind-blowing.
Yeah. It is. Absolutely. And you guys will stick around for 20 years on that, won't you? To get to the bottom of that.
We're in it now.
Yeah.
Did you say that they kill things like scrub hares?
Lots of scrub hares.
That big?
Yeah.
And how do they do that?
They're kind of ambush predators, I'd say. They might also work together in a group. So if one bird finds something, maybe a scrub hare's in a thicket somewhere, they will all come running and they will kind of ambush and kill the scrub hare.
Yeah. It's gruesome. And then they skin it somehow and rip it to shreds.
Yeah,
and
they'll probably fight over it. So often what we see coming to the nest is pieces of scrub hare. Yeah. Maybe an ear, a foot, a leg, a head. And each individual might bring a different body part.
That's extraordinary.
Vicious.
And the chick will swallow those pieces whole, so they don't tear off the flesh. They swallow the entire animal.
You see what I mean about mafia assassins? And even when they're young, they take no nonsense. Again, when you finish listening, have a look at a chick seeing off a genet in one of the videos. There's another one seeing off a bunch of young baboons, can you believe it? Of course, a leopard is a different story, and they're one of the hornbill chicks' biggest predators, which is why, incidentally, the biologists have to be careful in choosing trees to place the nests that are not good parking places for leopards. The chicks have a relatively high mortality rate because they're very vulnerable and fragile, stuck up there in a nest and unable to fly. Ground hornbills are listed as threatened on a countrywide level, even though they're thriving in many protected areas of the Lowveld. But their territories are extremely large, about 100 square kilometres. So if the birds venture outside the parks in search of new places to settle, they need very safe locations to do so. Locations that don't have shiny objects and windows that reflect the sun, for instance.
I got a phone call the other day about someone recently bought a 3 million rand car, shiny car, but the hornbills don't like seeing their reflection because they think it's intruders, and they just destroyed the car. The paneling, the sunroof, all broken. So, not great for hornbills.
There was another incident, Kyle Mark told me, in which something like 200 windows were broken by ground hornbills in one day. People shoot them for that kind of crime. But the greatest threats to the Thunderbirds is same old, climate change, habitat destruction, particularly the felling of the big trees that they nest in, and mooty seekers, and electrocution, and poisoning, including lead poisoning from hunters' bullets that are lodged in other animals' carcasses. They really have so many man-made menaces. And that's why the Middletons try so hard to find safe locations and erect nests in the hope that one day long away, the birds might take a look at them and take occupation. It's a project in collaboration with local private nature reserves, and it's known as the Mabula Southern Ground Hornbill Lowveld Expansion Project.
Did you want to look in the nest?
No, thank you. I'm not getting on that thing.
Fully disappointed, we head for another nest. But as a whole, the project's results are far from disappointing because they're working in rescue and rehab as well. There are 11 groups of ground hornbills breeding now, and each female lays 2 eggs. The Middletons and their colleagues harvest 1 of the eggs because the chick would be rejected and starved to death anyway. In total, about 49 birds have been saved, which is not to be sneezed at. But what incredibly exciting research lies ahead of you.
Yeah.
For decades.
Yeah.
Will you stay around here to get it, to continue it?
This area, I mean, this project's been going for 24 years now. South Africa does not have a lot of long-term research projects, so this is actually such a, you know, epic, amazing, successful project, actually. That being said, we're still on the first generation of birds, but
yeah, that's what makes us so unusual.
No, that's what makes it so valuable, is that we have this long-term data now that we can actually start looking at the bigger questions.
Have you been on this 24 years? Have you taken it over?
We've been on for 8 years now.
Yeah.
And it won't be long before they also clock up 24 years, I would bet. And what I would like to know is how many times that ladder has been taken on and off the vehicle during those years. Anyhow, off we go to the next nest. The same ritual is repeated, ladder off the car, extended, and Kyle Mark climbs up to the next nest. It's in a tall, strong leadwood tree. And Lady Thunderbird has got a room with a view of the beautiful Klisseri River. And thankfully, the white noise of her life won't be those awful cicadas in the Mopani Veld.
But this one I see is wooden.
Yeah, this is one of our wooden pieces.
It's rather like a Wendy house that your dad would...
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So it's double layered. So there's an internal nest, and then there's an air gap and then an external wood around it. So the idea is to provide shade to the internal layer and with that air gap to provide some kind of convective cooling, right, when air flows through the spaces between the nests.
Yet again, there are no chicks and no eggs, despite the luxury of the nursery. I'm surprised Lady Thunderbird hasn't taken occupation, actually, because what's available to her elsewhere can be life-threatening for the chicks.
Some natural cavities in living trees are lovely and cool. We find that they're much cooler than artificial nests. But some that are in dead trees are very hot, and they often don't have a roof, so they're exposed. There may be open-top cavities, so they're exposed to the elements. So if the female isn't sitting with the chick's exposed to the sun, exposed to the rain. Even had reported cases of chicks drowning in these nests because they're exposed in the rain, a big downpour of rain, and it just the nest fills up. So these nests at least can provide shelter from that with the roof. Yeah.
So you put up the nests and then you wait.
Yep.
And you wait.
It's old saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink.
But there's the other one, if you build it, they will come.
Yeah, true.
The trouble is, they don't.
No, they come. They've definitely been,
yeah.
They have. Oh, you can see signs of them. And they come to check it out.
Yeah, there's lots of leaf lining, but there's also genet scat in there. So it means there's also been a genet in and out.
Well, that could be breakfast, given what they
could
eat.
Could be. It kind of goes both ways. They can eat genets, but genets also eat them.
Sure. Okay. What's the longest you've waited for a nest to fill in you?
Years. We've had some that we put up 6 years ago and they've still not been used.
They've been found by the birds, but not used.
Yeah. So that just really shows, especially for inexperienced groups or new groups to an area, they don't prioritize, maximize breeding efforts. They wait until everything's just right. So the female needs to feel safe. She needs to feel like the males are going to provide for her. The area needs to be safe. You know, sometimes some of these trees have a tendency that leopards also use the trees. And that will definitely deter birds from breeding for sometimes even years. So once they get going and once they use a nest and are successful, that's where we see that they return and they're successful. But that initial, for new groups to start breeding, takes a very long time. And they're only really mature enough to breed from about 4, 5, 6 years old.
Very young, but
we find in that those young birds are often not successful initially. You know, they might not be the best attentive mothers.
So just explain to me, it's an alpha female, mm-hmm. but she can be a very young one.
In that case, it might just be that it's a newly established group,
mm-hmm.
Or if old female has died. We don't know for sure.
We don't really know where the females go at this point. The sex ratio when hatching is 50-50. And then there's only one female per group. So it's a big question of, you know, where the female's going. We've got on record a female hatched from a nest, disappeared for 10 years, not a sighting, and then, boom, started breeding in a new group. In a new area.
Because you're ringing them.
We ring them, so we can keep track of who's who.
Wow, fascinating.
So we've got tracking devices, new tracking devices that we're going to start implementing now. But it's also new technology and all of that. So we're really hoping it's going to be successful. It's just also the ring. It's like a tracking device in one of the rings. So it's straightforward. It doesn't annoy them. And all great in theory.
Wow, I find that fascinating. Just leaves for a decade.
Yeah.
That must surely be one of the great mysteries of ornithology. Where do female ground hornbills go until they're ready to mate? I imagine a kind of secret convent in the far reaches of the park where they take a vow of celibacy and wander around in their black habits till the urge for kids gets too much for them. Kyle, Mark and Carrie carry out their familiar ritual, check for eggs and chicks and check the camera footage.
So you're actually looking at footage there?
Yeah.
And then when you come back for monitoring, you can fast forward it.
Yeah, so we can flick through the pictures and see. Mm.
Okay. It's a remarkably good lens.
Yeah, these cameras are really, really good. Get such good quality.
And audio quality, and that's why we can actually...
The cameras provide a quite magical insight into the hornbills' habits and behaviour. As I said before, the Middletons have given us several clips of what they've captured over the years. So when you've finished listening to this episode, go and have a look at them, because then you'll know what I'm referring to. And of course, it's the audio quality of the recordings that's critical to Kyle Mark's research. What he's finding is that each bird has its own identifiable, what would you call it, accent, pitch, melody?
You know, it says, does it vary? Do some have?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's what Kyle found, that some have more syllables, if you like, you know, more notes to the call than others. Some have a very short call, some really extend the call, and then the frequencies differ between groups. So it definitely acts as a way for groups to recognize each other and to recognize which groups are a threat.
The birds were more passive to groups that they would recognize, so their neighbors, but as soon as there was a stranger vocalizing on the boundary of their territory, they responded much more aggressively and would actually approach and go and investigate what's actually happening. Who is this group and why is this group here? It's very interesting to get that little slither of information that builds on the bigger picture and everything.
All comes together.
Yeah.
Full
orchestra. Yeah.
In 15,000 years' time.
Interesting to think about the effects of, you know, a lot of people will call birds on their, you know, they've got their app on their phone and call them in, and, you know, we don't really know the effects to birds that are breeding. That can actually really upset them and possibly ruin their day, and when they're spending energy trying to find these intruders. But there are no intruders, but they're wasting energy into that where they could be foraging and doing other things. So that's something to consider.
That should come with a big health warning on the box or on the app.
It should, actually. You know? Actually, that's actually a very, very valid point. It should have a little, like, disclaimer, like, please be considerate.
Yeah. You know?
I'm telling you, this is rain. I'm telling you.
And wouldn't rain have been just so appropriate to end off a day in search of the thunderbirds? Some believe that the ground hornbills are called that because they bring rain. But it's because their booming tuba calls can mostly be heard when they're breeding in the rainy season. What most of us believe, I hope, is that these birds need to be helped to survive and flourish. They're one of our most iconic creatures, and we have so much still to learn about them. When I stood and looked out over the vast spread of the Kliseri wilderness, lying open to the sun and rain and sky, I felt so sad. These weird birds, so primitive looking, so Jurassic in their appearance, don't have the cuddly appeal of the charismatic megafauna, the lions and leopards and elephants that we all love. But they're part of the complex web of interrelations created by evolution. These birds belong in the African wilderness. They deserve to live on. Just imagine how empty the bushveld would feel if the thunderbirds and their booming call were no more than a sad, distant memory, like the dodo and the woolly mammoth. Carrie Hickman and Kyle Mark Middleton are doing their damnedest to ensure that doesn't happen. My great thanks to them for taking me into the low felt svelte and for answering a barrage of questions afterwards. Also for providing us with such wonderful clips of the birds in and around their nests. Please, please go and have a look at those in the gallery attached to this podcast. And a quick note, I had to call Carrie Middleton simply for ease of reference, even though she's kept her maiden name Hickman. Sorry, Carrie. Now we bow. Okay, Potpourri is next, and it comes out on the third Wednesday of each month. The stories that will be featured this month will be as much a surprise to me as to you. The reason? Well, I'll tell you then. Don't forget to follow us if you like our show. Please, it's critical ensuring that we can carry on doing what we do. And please send us your stories. Go to my website, storycatcher.co.za. There's a little form you can fill out. Okay, all the best for now.